So I've been really encouraged by this session, especially Dave, your comments leading off of thinking about the future. And I think it's a great time to be a pedologist right now. I think we've got lots of opportunities for the future and lots of potential for making some huge advancements. One thing you heard from my comment, people who were here earlier, to Dave, once I began working in other countries, I began to really understand the value that we have in the soil survey in the United States. It's a basic infrastructure for a nation to build and grow upon. We take it for granted a lot of times, I think, that a lot of the, I mean, we think agriculture when we think of soils, but and we forget the fact that hydrologic models that represent the risk of flooding that protects people's lives, one of the base layers that goes into that is soil survey. Some of the risk assessments of landslides, soil survey. These are big issues that I think are not really realized, that the value of that soil survey is embedded within all of society, not just agriculture. So I want to think about the soil survey a little bit, and I'll repeat a lot of what's been said, but mostly from my view of it. I've been thinking a lot about the soil survey and how it was made, and why things have been done the way they have been done. You think about the challenge that the people within the soil survey had starting in the 1900s with a paper and pencil. They had to divide up the landscape in some meaningful, reasonable way that wasn't necessarily based on fertility, but based on the natural structure of the landscape. And how would you do that? And so they had to use one symbol to symbolize how the soils change across the landscape. And then linking that to Ceres, since Ceres was already sort of embedded within the system, and then linking that to taxonomy became a way to communicate information with one symbol. So that's the structure that was set. Also, because of the paper and pencil technology, we're limited to polygons, even though we recognize within a landscape there's a continuum across the landscape, but we had no way with the technology to represent that. And so if they had computers, I wonder how it would have been different. And so I've been thinking about what could we do different. Not that we want to get rid of the survey the way it is, because there's too many links to society with the survey the way it is. It's linked to taxes, it's linked to land evaluation, it's linked to what people understand when they say a name. It communicates information. So we would never want to abandon what we have. But we should also think about targeting what are the needs of the customers in the current age. And from what I've experienced by talking to people, they want more highly resolved information that suits the needs of the technology that's advancement, especially in row crop agriculture. The survey is a great base, but what's on top of that? What sort of more information can we gain from that? So we look at the survey. This is an example of a shot in Indiana. We've got the polygons that are linked to the taxonomy and linked to all of the properties that's within the database. But the way it's delivered is polygon. It's not explicit, this continuum that we all understand and see and have observed. And we have these inclusions that can't be represented, and people want to know where those inclusions are, and they'd like to know something about those inclusions. How are they working differently? But it's created with the best technology of the time, and you know, a huge advance in the technology was aerial photographs and stereo pairs. I mean, that was absolutely huge for advancement. But we're at a place now where we have much more potential than stereo pairs and aerial photographs. And I think it's really time that we start as a community with a focus on the creative ways that we can use the legacy information with the new tools we have that are available to begin to answer questions that the customer, the society has. And that we will be rewarded with that, I think, by providing value to society. One of the issues that we definitely have to work on, Dave pointed out, this is a project that I worked on with a hydrologist, comes to me and says, here's our hydrologic groups, what's going on here? And so, well, this was mapped 10 years before this one, different labels, different names, got associated with different properties. And so this is when I really started working on trying to develop methods where we could make continuous property maps and maps that related to a function that of a particular interest. And this is one of the issues that we'll have to think about in the future. Every user group will have different questions that will want the information packaged in a different way. That's a challenge for us, but that's not something that we should not take seriously and begin to focus on. So his challenge was, he said, I'm writing this threshold exceedance Lagrangian model, and really the big thing I need is available water storage. So we went to work and started looking at legacy data, legacy information, and were able to create a map of available water storage so he could use this as input in his hydrology model. It was a very simple model, but it performed better than a SWAT model that took 2 weeks to process on a TerraGrid processor, only looking at stream flow at the outlet. It didn't get the spatial aspects of it, but that was not his question. So these question-specific data is very important. And you think about some of the potential we have. This is, you know, work from Sharon Waltman looking at the entire United States, gridding the Surgo data. And at this scale, it is amazing and extremely useful at this scale. But when we start getting to the scale of a farm where a producer has questions, we're still dealing with this, with the structure of the polygon-based soils with inclusions. So we have to think about scale when we think about soil information as well. So this scale, wonderful. Well, the product we have, great. But when we start thinking about the questions at a particular farm scale, then we have to think about what can we do different or better to provide that kind of information to the producers. Last week or 2 weeks ago, I was in Napa, California, and I was co-organizing an NSF workshop on the food, energy, water nexus. And so we had two panel groups. The first panel group was users. They were grape growers, nut growers, fruit growers, and every single one of the eight people said we need better soil information. We're dealing with this drought. We have spatial variability across our field. We realized we could change water usage, but how? Farmers are all have to take risk, and they don't change very much because they have to shoulder that risk. They will when they get the right information and the data and they begin to believe it and see it's working, then they will change their management practices. But risk is what they have to manage as much as soils and everything. So. But the panel two was engineers, scientists, and the whole focus was we need better sensors, we need new sensing techniques, we need big data analysis, and which absolutely we do need that. But the nexus is we need to link the needs of the people using the information with how we as scientists are approaching the question. We have to link the better sensors to application of spatial information. We have to link the big data analysis of what can we understand about spatial landscapes and to answer the questions that the users have. But I think whatever we do in any digital mapping that we do, we can't lose the connection between the landscape and what's been known since Milne found out in the 30s. That is crucial because it describes our landscapes, and it describes how soils vary. So we can't do any, in my opinion, I mean, we shouldn't use any technique that loses that connection to the landscape that we've understood and known. Also, you always see Yenny's model. Still, I mean, we cannot lose the connection to Yenny's model no matter what digital mapping technique that we use, because we can't find a place where it's not proven correct. If we understand all five of these factors, we understand that the soils vary based on those factors. So we've been working a little bit on a technique of mapping. This is a digital elevation model on the left and a algorithm called the topographic wetness index on the right. It's very interesting because it basically describes that if soil was a pavement, where would the water shed? Where would the water accumulate? In the blues is where water would accumulate, and the reds is where water would shed. So the relief factor in Yenny's model It's not relief that's driving the soil variability. It's the water that's driving the soil variability. Relief only describes how water is redistributed after a rainfall event over geologic time that develops the patterns that we've been able to map based upon. So using this kind of information and thought and understanding of the processes that we're trying to capture, we can begin to make digital maps at the resolution that people are interested in. And this is looking at the available water storage from the Sergel map on the left with the polygon-based mapping, and then looking at predicting the properties at 5 meter pixel resolution on the right of available water storage capacity. So you can see, if you fly over the Midwest, you see these kind of patterns on plowed fields. They're there, and they're there because of the water redistribution. Once you maintain the four factors the same, and at the resolution of a field, I believe that the water and topography is driving the variability. At the resolution of a watershed, it's the geology and maybe the vegetation. And you back out a little further, it's the climate. So thinking about this hierarchy of where is the level of variability that we can utilize information that's available to describe and make predictions is extremely important. But we made property maps of the upper 10 centimeters of CEC and organic matter. But this is a way. I think by combining this information, you can begin to put it into more management units or ways that people can think about how can I work on this particular piece of my farm differently than this, or where can I minimize fertilizers? Because I think precision farming in the past has been to the focus was to minimize the variability across the field, get all the corn up to 200 bushels per acre. I think by application and 20 years of work, we've realized that's almost an impossible task, because at that upper right-hand corner where you have 50 centimeters of soil, you don't have enough water to utilize the nutrients to get up to 200 bushels an acre. So what we're realizing and beginning to think about is how do you manage your inputs so that if you have 50 centimeters of soil, you probably don't want to load it up with a bunch of nitrogen because you're wasting your money. Thinking about that is beginning to answer a different question and a different goal, I think, than trying to minimize variability, but maximize and utilize the right management tools in the right zones. But working in Central America, it's really interesting because we get to start without a soil survey. So we get to think about what would we do in the modern era of creating a soil survey. So we're, I think it's kind of like going from telephone that are hooked to landlines to cell phones. We can think differently. If we just started with cell phones, we'd be thinking much differently than we start with landlines. So it's been an enjoyable experience so far. We're mapping El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Guatemala at the resolution of the DEM to predict properties. And we're trying to use the knowledge of a soil scientist as more driven than points. And I think it's kind of like if you think it loosely, like the Bayesian statistics, where you're more knowledge driven at the beginning, and then as data comes, you become more quantitatively driven. Because if we just rely on numbers alone without the knowledge of the pedologists who've mapped in the field for 30 years, we could not make the project go forward. So when we're in an area where we don't have data, we go to the guy who's mapped 30 years and say, what's the carbon? Just the same way we did in the United States. I mean, we didn't analyze every series. We didn't analyze every landscape. What we did, we picked up patterns and understood the processes that relate to those patterns and what are the driving factors that related to those properties, and then populated our database. We're doing the same thing, but we can do it more quickly. And so this is an example of southern part of Honduras in the Chulateca River Basin in the Namasigua watershed. We scanned a topo that was made for the area, made it into a raster, and predicted the continuous properties. It's largely Zamir's work here. 5 minutes, okay. But, you know, beginning to predict the continuous property maps, and the thing about going from properties to grouping as polygons is you can group it taxonomically if you want to. if you have the properties. Or you can group it as a functional unit to focus on highly erodible areas. Or so starting at a different point. And so that's the goal. But the interesting thing, and I think the most useful thing, is you can begin and see how this becomes extremely useful to people who are managing, because you can drill down to half hectare, 2 hectares, where the size of some of these farms for the small farmers, and to give them some ideas or some boundary conditions of generally what's your pH, generally what are the problems you're going to have. But the best part is that we're creating version 1 maps in these countries, and people for version 2 will be going collecting more information, doing observations, putting that back into the model for version 2. So it's hopefully it will develop a survey that where it will continue to keep building and growing, and it will give jobs for pedologists to continue to make useful information for properties that people can put together in a way to manage for their specific problem. But just as an example, here's the currently available soil map for that area. One big polygon, one number. And so I think we have the ability to do this. And I think that this is one way. There's many, many ways, but I don't think it's been a focus of our discipline yet, and I think it should be. I think there's so many, especially I look at these young people. You're way smarter than I am, I'm sure, and you'll think of way more creative ways to do this. But I think it should be our goal, honestly, or one of our goals. But the other thing I mentioned, too, was the fact that people could take a book, go to the field, pull it out, see where they were, and see what their soil information was. That was crucial for the soil survey. And I think about the soil surveys around the world that's built up and died. I think if you have to sit at your office or you have to, that's not where your questions are. Your questions are in the field. You want to take the information there. And one thing, project that's led by Daryl Schultz at Purdue, but Thompson's on part of, and Alfred's part of, it's taking tablets, and so this is taking iPads to the field where you got your maps, you see where you stand, you can flip through the layers, and then you can make a mental connection from what you're seeing there to what data says in the field. So I think that is something the survey should focus on in the future, of how do we move to the digital world, basically. And this is one thing that we shouldn't overlook, because it's extremely important to be able to take data, information to the field, to make those spatial connections, to begin to understand the agronomics of what's going on, or understand the potential for flooding or potential for erosion, because we understand the properties, we know the properties and how properties relate to processes. So with that, I guess I have time for a question.
Yeah.
Yes. That's a resolution. Well, actually, the resolution was 1.5 meters, but of the DM. Well, we downsampled to 5 because we found that if you try to use anything finer resolution than 5, it creates so much noise you can't develop relationships. And so, if you think about it, as we would look at a place and say, here's where we should put a pet on, and we would think in a resolution of probably a little bit bigger than that, but it makes no sense to get any finer than that, because I think we're already sort of stretching the ability to predict there.
Okay, one more. There's one more.
Yes.
So there is a slide you showed of the servo database, but it's TA-ATA and the hydraulic property or something. And is there any API we can access?
So if you want to use the the wetness index? Yeah, go to Saga. It's free software. We're using QGIS, which has the Saga Wetness Index embedded. It's the Saga package, S-A-G-A. It's a very powerful terrain analysis software. It's free.
Okay.